Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Ann Danahy. Jason Wright is an associate professor of astronomy and astrophysics at Penn State. He's also a champion of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. While research in that field has been largely dormant in recent years, Wright is among those leading the charge for a return of funding from NASA. His work was recognized earlier this year when he received the Drake Award from the SETI Institute. Jason Wright, thank you for coming in to talk with us.
My pleasure.
So you received this award from the SETI Institute, and SETI stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. I think for many people, when you think of extraterrestrial intelligence or ET, what comes to mind is ET, the movie, or Star Trek. But what does it mean to you, the term SETI? What does it mean to scientists?
So it's funny you say that. If I asked you instead what comes to mind if you think of scientists who are looking for signals from extraterrestrial civilizations, then what image or movie might come to mind for you? And you might say Jodie Foster, headphones on, from the movie Contact.
Right. Which is what, searching for life.
Right. Searching for life with radio waves. I think that movie, which was written by Carl Sagan, really captures a lot of what I think of when I think about that sort of thing, which is, what can we do today as scientists to see if anyone is out there in a scientifically rigorous way, rather than in science fiction, where it's usually them coming to visit us in spaceships and things like that, which is not generally what we're thinking about when we think about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
So in the announcement for the award that you just recently received, the president and CEO of the SETI Institute says, "We are on the cusp of the most exciting period in human history for space exploration, and the search for signs of intelligent life beyond Earth has never been more compelling." And he goes on to say that you're a pioneer in that research. Why do you think this is one of the most potentially exciting times? I mean, do you agree with that? And why do you think so?
Oh, certainly. So it was at the end of the 1950s that radio astronomers realized that we, humanity, were capable of sending a signal into space that we, humanity, would be able to detect at interstellar distances. That is, if there were a bunch of scientists just like us on a planet around, say, Alpha Centauri, the nearest star, we could send a signal that, they could detect. And that really made it possible to even conceive of how we might communicate across the stars. Before that, it was just, maybe they're out there, but how would we know, except for these science fiction fables about spaceships and stuff like that. And since then, this argument that we should be looking for such signals has just steadily gotten stronger. So around the same time that radio waves were proposed as a way to do it, Charlie Townes, who invented the laser, realized that we could also generate lasers that would be detectable at interstellar distances. And then people started thinking bigger and said, well, why are we limiting ourselves to technology that we can generate? If they're out there, they've probably been out there for millions or even billions of years. They might be able to do things with technology that's much bigger than our technology that we would be able to detect even if we couldn't make that kind of thing. And so that's led to all sorts of new ideas about how we might go finding extraterrestrial technology. The other thing that's changed a lot is that computing power. So looking through lots and lots of radio data is very slow. And when people like Frank Drake first started these projects, it was a bit like going down your radio dial. He would pick one frequency and he'd point at a particular star. And then he would just sit there with his radio telescope and see if he could record any additional information coming from that star. And then he would tune to the next channel over, small motions, and check the next one.
It's like looking through the grains of sand.
Exactly. Today, radio telescopes can search billions of channels at once, billions with a B at once. And we also now have telescope arrays that can point at multiple stars at the same time. So we can now search literally billions of times faster than we could in the 1960s. And that is in large part due to electronics and computers that can sift through all that data so quickly.
And one other throwback I'm thinking of, some people might remember having or hearing about the SETI screensavers, and it was something you could have on your on your computer. And while you weren't using your computer, it could in the background be helping in the search for life, helping searches. Is that still
That's exactly it, and that's absolutely still out there. So the idea there is that the radio telescopes can actually record everything that they detect, but to actually look through all that data and see if there's a signal in it is extremely computationally intensive. You need an enormous supercomputer to do it. And so some folks at Berkeley worked out how you could just borrow everyone's computer. So instead of buying your own supercomputer, you would farm the data out to every laptop and office computer in the world and have them crunch on it when you weren't using it overnight or whatever, whenever the screensaver turned on. And so, yeah, SETI at Home, it's called, you can still download it on your machine and it will still crunch through the data, and you will definitely help us make progress sifting through this all this data that we're looking for.
Okay, so it's still out there. Is it needed as much?
It is needed as much, absolutely, because we can collect data much faster than we can process it. And so they're careful about, you know, making sure that the data you're working on are the data that need working on. And if it's your computer that stumbles across the signal in this search, then, you know, you'll be involved in the discovery announcement as the person whose computer did it.
You'll be a star celebrity, too. maybe, right. Maybe. So we recently celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Apollo landing on the moon, and NASA is looking at going to the moon. There's lots of discussion going to the moon again and then on to Mars. Do you think as a country, again, we're more open to that idea, more excited about those things?
It certainly feels like it. I mean, all of these new space ventures, and they're going to mine asteroids, and Elon Musk is going to die on Mars. You know, all of this stuff, I think, has really captured public imagination in a way that, you know, I don't remember for quite a long time. I think the statements about things like settlements on Mars are more fiction than fact. If we want to live permanently on Mars, for instance, that means a self-contained habitat. We don't know how to build a self-contained habitat on Earth, right? We had Biosphere 2 in Arizona, which was trying to do that. You know, it did pretty well. It was a great progress, but we still don't know how to do that in Arizona, much less a place like Antarctica, which would be thousands of times easier than doing it on Mars. So we're a long way from a permanent settlement. But the idea that in our lifetimes, maybe a human will walk on Mars, that's possible, I think.
Okay, so it's kind of differentiating between the what's actually doable and having the dreams that are out there.
That's right. But, you know, if we really wanted to learn how to do that, if we were willing to do a moonshot and invest billions of dollars in knowing how to build a permanent settlement, I think that's a governmental level expenditure, but that is something that could happen. We'd have to think hard, though, about that. I mean, you can't put people on Mars without putting a lot of Earth life on Mars. I mean, we're covered in a microbiome. Everything we touch is covered with microbes. We're very interested in Mars as a potential habitat for Martian life. We think that it may have been, we know it had water at some point. And so we think there's good reason to think that it once had life all over it. And if you do a life detection experiment, and it says, yes, I detected life, but this is somewhere people have been walking around. It's like, well, yeah, duh, obviously.
Okay, so it could compromise it.
We need to think very hard about preserving Mars as a laboratory to see if it had past life. And if it currently has subterranean life, we need to think even harder about what it would mean for us to go there.
There are still skeptics among scientists and the public. And getting ready for this interview, I was, you know, doing some reading about it, and I came across this headline: "The scientists searching for alien life aren't very popular in science." Is there any truth to that?
Some truth. When I first got into this field, I was a little bit worried about the reaction of my colleagues. I was worried about maybe the reaction of the university. And I was pleasantly surprised to have very little pushback about what I was working on. The university here has been extremely supportive of it. My department's been supportive. And so I think something has changed. And this comes, I think, somewhat from the fact that it's a more compelling search today than it's been in the past. The big thing that changed was in the mid-90s, we discovered planets around other stars like the sun. And before that, we just didn't know if sites of life, potential life in the galaxy, were ubiquitous or not. We now know that virtually every star in the galaxy has planets.
Okay.
And many of those planets, like not one in 100, more like one in four or something, or one in four of those stars will have at least one planet that is something like a place where we might expect liquid water to be in there for life, something like Earth, not Earth 2.0 or anything like that, but a potential site for life. So a lot of the arguments that Earth is extremely rare have lost a lot of their salience, and we now expect that, you know, if life is a common process of conditions like Earth, that it'll be common in the galaxy. And that's really changed the calculus of how worthwhile it would be to go looking for not just microbes on Mars or trace gases of biosignatures in the atmospheres of distant planets, but actual signs of technology.
So one other quote from a skeptic, and you've written about the lack of funding for this type of research in a piece for Scientific American. You wrote that when Nevada Senator Richard Bryan introduced an amendment in the 90s ending funding for a NASA program, and you quote him as saying, this hopefully will be the end of Martian hunting season at the taxpayers' expense.
Right.
So it sounds like you're saying that that attitude has shifted.
I think it has shifted a lot in Congress. Congress has a couple of times put the search for signs of technology, we call them technosignatures, in draft language. Now, none of that language has become law yet. It's either come out, you know, in the House version or in, you know, reconciliation between the two houses or something like that. But we're hopeful that the fact that people keep trying to put it in means that sooner or later it will end up there. And there have been hearings about the hunt for life in the universe, in the Senate and in the House. And we've had representatives of the SETI community who are looking for radio signals, you know, invited to testify before Congress on that topic. And so I don't think that bashing the field or cutting its funding gives the same political rewards that it gave in the 80s and 90s. I think it's quite the opposite. And so I'm hopeful that that will lead to a thaw in the near future.
There's another type of skepticism, and it might be that, okay, you know, that's really interesting, and I can understand why you want to do it. But this is, we're talking millions, hundreds of millions, I don't know, billions of dollars, and we need that money mm-hmm. for the problems we're having right now here on Earth.
Oh, I absolutely agree that we need that money for the problems we have here on Earth. The fact is that, you know, we're a very rich planet and we're a rich country, and there are a lot of things that we can do to make the world better. And I would, you know, I would not want to take money from a vital program helping people and put it towards something even basic science. That was the choice we were being forced to make. But that really is not the choice we were being forced to make. For reference, if you look at how much money NASA spends on all of science, all the science that it does, and you compare it to something like what Americans spend on their pets, or not just on their pets, but feeding their pets, or not just feeding their pets, but feeding their pets treats, just the treats cost more.
The treats cost more than yes. what's being spent.
So we can afford science, and some small fraction of that, not zero, we can afford to answer the biggest questions we've ever asked that we might be on the verge of answering. That's worth it.
Penn State recently received commitments for about $3.5 million to set up the Penn State Extraterrestrial Intelligence Center. And a video about the center talks about the goals of finding out if we're alone in the universe and what our place is in the universe. Do you think you and other scientists will be able to answer those questions in your lifetime?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. But I know we have to try. I mean, that's what science is for. And, you know, it often takes you in really unexpected directions. So I'm sure that by looking for these things and thinking about these things, that we will learn a lot and we will find a lot of surprises, because we're going out and we're looking for things that aren't natural. We're looking for things that we didn't think should be out there. And whenever you do that and you open up new discovery spaces, you always find new and interesting things. And sometimes they're just curios, and sometimes they're total game changers that teach you huge amounts about the universe. And so I know that we'll be doing a lot of good science whether or not we answer those questions.
And so the goal is to raise $110 million, and that seems pretty daunting. Will you be able to continue to start doing the work before you get there?
Absolutely. So the reason the number is so high is that we're trying to endow this forever. This isn't money that we want to spend down and then we're done. We've learned over the decades that we cannot rely on Congress and NASA to fund this in a persistent way. And the way science works is that you train the next generation by doing it and having them do it, and then they train the next generation. And when you have 25-year funding gaps, you break the chain. And right now, for instance, there are only two graduate courses that I'm aware of anywhere in the world that teach this subject to graduate students who want to do it and get a degree working on this problem.
And you teach one of those, right?
And we teach one of them here at Penn State. That's right. The other is at UCLA. And only in the history of the world, as far as I can tell, around the world since SETI started, there have only been six people that have worked on this project as part of a PhD in the physical sciences in 60 years. So we need a permanent source of funding that can persist and allow that training chain to continue. And so the $110 million is to endow all of these efforts. So we want to train people from the undergraduate level all the way through their PhDs. We want to make sure that there are grants available to anyone around the world to get training wherever they want it and to continue working on it. Because, you know, you get a degree in a field where there are literally no jobs or almost no jobs. That's a daunting prospect, and we're not going to get the best people working on it.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. We're talking with Jason Wright, an associate professor of astronomy and astrophysics at Penn State. Wright is part of the Penn State Extraterrestrial Intelligence Center. Do you personally think there are other forms of life out there? And we talked about this a little bit, but do you see being able to contact them in some way in your lifetime?
So it's the numbers game. Seems that there's got to be life out there. And I don't know why life would necessarily always be simple. Complex life took a while, as far as we can tell. It took quite a while to arise here on Earth. But my gut tells me that complex life is pretty common among places that have life and that life is probably pretty common in the universe. As for whether we can detect their technology or not, that's hard. I really don't know, because it requires two to do this tango. They have to do something that we could detect, and then we have to think to look for that. So we're trying to guess at the motivations and the actions and intentions of truly alien, you know, species. And just to give a sense of how alien, you know, science fiction has trained us to think of alien technologies being operated by aliens that look like us.
Right? In some way, right.
They two have arms and two eyes and all of this stuff. And that's because science fiction's not really about aliens. It's really about us, right? That's what it's about. But when we finally do discover life elsewhere in the universe, you know, you and I will be more closely related to a sycamore tree than we will be related to that alien. And so will they build radio telescopes? That's a very human thing to do. Would they do it? I don't know.
So it's really beyond our imagination, the capabilities to even come up with what they might
be. And so if you told me that, you know, magically I could know there is exactly one intelligent species elsewhere in the galaxy, I'd say we're probably not going to stumble across them. But, you know, it's a numbers game. If it's ubiquitous throughout the galaxy, and especially if they spread among the stars, if they can establish settlements on stars throughout the galaxy, there might be, you know, millions of sites throughout the galaxy with potentially detectable technology. And that's, I think, our best bet is if that's the case.
If you get a message or a signal in some way, do you know whether that they're still alive or if it's from a bazillion years ago?
It's gonna really depend on what it is that we detect. The distances in interstellar space are vast, but I think sometimes people tend to overestimate how vast they are. It's a case where we actually, you know, our instincts are actually, they go too far in terms of size.
We're overcompensating.
Size, right. So, I mean, most of the stars that you see in the night sky, the light left, you know, within human history. In fact, just about all of them. And so the round trip, communication times, if they send a signal and then if we were to somehow respond, assuming it's a signal that, you know, warrants response or they're listening, the round trip times we're talking about are probably decades, maybe centuries, but not, you know, millions of years or something like that. So it's unlikely that in the intervening decades or centuries or even millennia that, like, you know, they all would have died or something like that. So no, if we detect a signal within the galaxy or see any sign of technology within the galaxy, it's probably been there a long time and will continue to be there for a long time.
And it's hard to know what those signals would look like or sound like or be.
Right. So, I mean, we talk about contact, but what we really mean is detection. It's very unlikely that there's going to be any kind of exchange going on. I mean, unless there's something in the solar system waiting to communicate with us, some sort of probe or something like that, what's probably going to happen is that we're going to intercept a signal from, you know, 100 light years away or 1,000 light years away or something like that. And it's probably, in my opinion, others disagree, I suspect it's not going to be a signal pointed at Earth for us to detect. Like, if you ask, what's the most obvious source of technology on Earth? Like, how would they know we're here? It turns out to be our radar.
Okay.
So, like, ICBM radar in the Arctic or airport radar and things like that. And, you know, if they're getting those radar signals, they're just going to see this weird static. I mean, it's obviously artificial if they can detect it strongly enough. But, you know, if they try to decode it or guess what it's for, they're probably gonna strike out. So they'll just know there's a weird source of radio emission, probably technological, around that star over there. And that's probably what we're going to figure out, too.
And your research looks at byproducts from extraterrestrial intelligence. Is that right? Is that part of it? And or what we were just talking about now, is that like an example of what a byproduct might be?
Yeah. So, I mean, we talk about unintentional emissions or, you know, leaked emissions is often the way that we put it. I think that's an important way to go. It used to be we wouldn't look for those sorts of signals because they would always just be too weak. We had no hope of detecting them. The only signals we could have detected in the 60s, you know, at least the strengths that we emit, were the ones, you know, that were deliberately, you know, we put a megawatt of power just at that star as loud as we can. It lasts for 5 minutes, you know, and they'd better be listening during those 5 minutes at just the right channel.
Right.
So, you know, it's a tall order. But now we have much more sensitive telescopes and we have much better ways of detecting those signals. We think we understand them better. And so I think we have a better shot at detecting leaked emission.
What about the concern that's raised about other forms of life, that if they're out there,
right,
whatever they is, that they might not be benevolent? That
sure.
Maybe we don't want to find them and we don't want them to find us.
So if we detect them, like I said, we will just know that there is something over there on that star that's technological. That's what we will know. So that doesn't necessarily alert them to our presence. That doesn't necessarily change anything. It just gives us more information. I mean, it's certainly possible that if we establish contact, if they notice that we're here, that would be very bad for us. Whether, you know, they intend to or not, that would be bad for Earth. That's possible. It's also possible it would be very good for us. I mean, remember, you know, these are more alien to us than sycamore trees. This isn't, you know, Buck Rogers.
Right.
We really don't know what's going to happen. The physical distances involved are so vast that, you know, unless they've already been on their way here for millennia, you know, we've got a few thousand years to figure this out. So that's okay, too. So I think the connection between, you know, listening and seeing if anything's out there and the consequences that they're going to eat us or something, I think that's a very tenuous connection based on a lot of fallacies, actually.
The UK SETI Research Network is actually surveying the public about this type of work, mm-hmm, and how we should respond. And just as an example of the type of question, some people think we should send messages into space, mm-hmm, even if we don't receive a message first. What is your opinion? So they're collecting public opinion on that. What do you think of that idea, finding out what the public thinks?
I think it's important. I think it's really important that we communicate to the public what we're doing. And I think it's important that we have this conversation collectively, because I don't think we're ready for what happens when we succeed. We are not prepared for success. I don't personally think it matters if we send signals or not. Our interplanetary radar and our, you know, stuff is just, it's much more powerful and we're doing it all the time. And when we do deliberately send a message out, it's like I said, for 5 minutes to one star. The chances it'll matter are basically zero. But I think it's an important conversation to have. And I think we need to be better prepared for how we communicate success to the public and think hard about how success will be received. Now, unfortunately, how it's received depends on what we find, right? If we find slime on Mars that's been extinct for a billion years, you know, it's definitely front page New York Times.
Kind of cool,
it marks,
right,
an epoch, like, but, you know, everybody's still going to work in the morning. On the other hand, you know, if the saucer on the White House lawn, Close Encounters of the Third Time, that's very different, right? Arrival, that's very different. So what we find will be somewhere in between those extremes, I suspect. And depending on what we find, we're going to have to be able to answer questions about what we found. Because when we say we got a signal from space, people are immediately going to think contact, arrival, you know, Independence Day. Like, that's where everyone's minds are going to go. And we need to know how to handle that. And we are just not ready.
What do you mean by that? And what do we need to do to change that?
I think we need to communicate more with people who deal with risk communication. I mean, there are people who really understand how to do this. I mean, we talk to the public about, you know, earthquake preparedness. We talk to the public about, you know, nuclear war. Remember, we used to get under the desks and everything. And people have thought hard about how you make these communications. And even though I think that the discovery of life elsewhere in the galaxy is not some kind of crisis that we need to do anything about, the public reaction to the news is something we need to be ready for. Because there are, you know, there are apocalyptic cults and there's a lot of priming that's happened from science fiction. And there's going to be a lot of confusion about what we've found. And it's hard for scientists who don't talk to the public professionally to communicate clearly in ways that the public hears what they're actually saying. We use a lot of jargon. And we need to be working with people who know how to do that.
Yeah, because I can see that the concerns, whether or not it's reality, that all of a sudden it's like, oh, it's Mort calling Ork and people with tinfoil hats on and, you know, what's going on? It's craziness.
Right. Well, people are also primed to believe things like, you know, the government's going to cover it up. the government is going to communicate with them, like we can communicate with them, and most of these things are just not true. And so, of course, if you protest, no, that's not what's going on, well, you're part of the conspiracy. And so, I mean, this is a really hard, a really tough nut to crack, and we've barely given it any thought. If we succeeded tomorrow, I suspect it would be a PR disaster.
And you've said there's a lot of methods that we haven't tried yet when it comes to SETI. Can you give an example of things that might be explored mm-hmm. if you were to get all this funding, if it were to be something that NASA does start funding?
Yeah. So, I mean, what usually comes to mind for people is looking for radio signals. And we also look for laser flashes or laser lines that are coming. But, you know, we don't know what we're necessarily going to see. There are other ways of transmitting radio waves that we generally don't really explore very often because we don't think nature produces those. But that's actually a great reason to go looking for them because nature doesn't produce them. They could only be artificial. But what I'm really excited about is the big data revolution. Because we've got these supercomputers, astronomers have gotten ambitious and we're building gigantic detectors that can survey most of the sky every 3 days, for instance. That's a big project coming online called the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. The Breakthrough Listen Radio Project produces petabytes of data. And so we can take these huge astronomical surveys, many of which are being done, most of which are being done with no intention of finding technology, and look for all the stuff that shouldn't be there. And anomaly detection. And okay. In fact, there's a lot of machine learning algorithms coming out that are all about anomaly detection. You train them to, like, you know, to find cats and faces and pictures and things. But then if, you know, something really bizarre comes up, like an amoeba, you don't want it to say, probably a cat. You want it to say, wait, this is not like the others. What's that? And so if we can do that, then maybe we will find that oddball star, that oddball signal that shouldn't be there that otherwise we never would have even thought to look for.
We're talking, of course, about the United States and NASA and what it's doing. I just wondered, when you're talking with other scientists at conferences and whatnot, is there the same interest in this in other countries?
It's odd. I once had a journalist from Europe ask me why only Americans work on this problem. And that whenever he wanted to work on it, he went to America. And I thought that was odd, but that, you know, that was reflecting what he really saw. But there is a lot of radio SETI around the world. Australia has a long history of radio astronomy, and there's SETI work there. And then across Europe, in the UK, especially in Italy, there have been small radio SETI projects as well. So it really is a worldwide community. And when SETI started up, it was really the U.S. and the USSR were both working on it, and it was a point of scientific cooperation to think about this project. And there was even some sense of a sort of Cold War rivalry who would
friendly
detect them
competition.
First. Yes, exactly. Right. You know, Sagan and Kardashev would, you know, meetings and things like that.
Right, I could see that too now, that there would be that competition. I don't know if it would be friendly or not.
You know, as scientists like to work together, and if we find something, it's not going to be a military secret that gives someone an advantage. It's going to be something the whole world needs to know about.
Jason Wright, thank you for talking with us.
My pleasure.
We've been talking with Jason Wright, an associate professor of astronomy and astrophysics at Penn State and a champion of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. To hear this and other Take Note interviews, go to wpsu.org/take note. I'm Ann Danahy, WPSU.